chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. UNC grad, Moorhead Scholar, Rhodes Scholar, Robin Hadley has some good advice for students planning for college and some important help for their parents as well. And it's all assembled in a new book called Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College Bound Journey. And Robin Hadley has agreed to come over from Graham, North Carolina to share some of those secrets. It's good common sense advice is what you give, isn't it?
I like to think so. Just common sense advice. And I think a lot of parents feel that sometimes applying for college is a magic formula. So I tell them it's not magic, but it is a formula.
Oh, really? What's the formula?
I think the formula is trying to start as early as you can, really having conversations with your teenager, if at all possible, or kind of pouring it in, even if they don't appear to be responsive. But I think the bottom line is initially establishing some line of communication with your teenager to see if college is what they really want to do or what their career interest might be. I think traditionally we have focused or tended to focus on four-year colleges and universities, and now more than ever, many of our students are going into two-year institutions, getting that associate's degree, and then doing a university transfer. And then probably the other key thing is establishing relationships with folks at the school, whether it's a counselor.
At the school they're going to now.
That's correct. At their middle school or high school, just keep it engaged with what's going on at that school to make sure your child is getting exposed to a wide variety of opportunities, and I think trying to take the most challenging courses your child can take. And rigorous means something different for every child.
So what are the typical mistakes that parents make, but as you counsel with parents and with the children who are college bound or thinking about being college bound, what are some of the terrible errors, or what are some of the errors, the avoidable errors that people tend to make in this pre-college admissions process?
I think there are probably a couple of things. I think assuming that your teenager, in teens' words, they've got this. I think you talk to teenagers many times, whether it's about deadlines, whether they've actually submitted the application, whether it's a scholarship application, or whether they've submitted the application for governor school or summer camp. I think sometimes with teenagers, we know their intentions are good ones, but you must trust and verify. So, and that's not my quote. That comes from somewhere else. But I think many, many parents who come into my office or call me or meet me over the produce section at Walmart say, I just thought my child understood how to do this, or I thought it was done, and we didn't find out until later that he or she had missed the deadline.
So is that, I mean, if you had to rate them, that number one is falling off at the very critical time of application times, of writing the essay, filling out the forms, getting the recommendations, that the parents who trust their children too much may be surprised, and that the surprise is we miss this admission cycle.
In my experience, that is the case. I do think we certainly want to give our teenagers as much room, if you will, to do it on their own as well as to make mistakes. But the bottom line is they're 16, 17, and 18. So I think you have to kind of, what we encourage students to do is really create that junior year calendar or that senior year calendar. There are just some hard and fast things that are going to happen. If you've got a 9th, 10th, or 11th grader, the PSAT is only given once or twice. It's always in October. Those are things that have to be on your radar as a parent, because you can't always expect your teenager to say, you know what, I want to take the most difficult AP course at my school, and I want you to sign here to say that I can take it. So I think a lot of our, you know, you have a group of students who are going to take the absolute most rigorous courses at their school, but to a very large degree, I think parents really have to have some sense of what kind of courses, if you will, or pathways, as it's referred to at the state level. You have to make sure your child's got all their credits for math, all their credits for English. You can't just assume if they bring home a good report card and they're an A student or a B student that everything's done. You've got to make sure everything is ticked off as far as the calendar, whether it's, again, deadlines, or whether it's certain courses that they need to have taken by that junior or senior year. And I think we sometimes make assumptions, again, if they're an A student, they know how to do this. But if the child is going going to be a first-generation college student if the parent has not been to college, him or herself, and they're saying, well, you know, my child's in the top 10, you know, or my child's in the top 10%. I'm sure they know how to do this. And I think that's an inaccurate assumption. I think the other thing that happens is the counselor-student ratio, at least in our public high schools, has been growing. So that counselor...
In the particularly with the upcoming budget cuts, that there will not be readily available counselor help. You can't count on it being there.
Absolutely. And I think the to-do list, if you will, for counselors in general at most of our public high schools is a long one. So that's why I stress the importance of developing that relationship from that 9th or 10th grade year, particularly at the high school level, with the counselor. Because at the end of the day, this might be an individual that you have to go through to who's going to sign off or write that letter of recommendation for your child to be a Morehead Scholar or a Park Scholar, or even to get that $500 scholarship from the local Rotary club. And if it's not a counselor, then it may very well be a teacher or an administrator or a coach. That's part of that formula I'm talking about. These are individuals who at some point might have to be a reference for your child, whether it's for employment, a scholarship application, or a college application. So that's part of that formula I say that's not magic, but you have to have a sense, for example, of what college admissions officers nowadays are taking a look at when they look at college applications. As an example, UNC Chapel Hill has become more competitive. All of these colleges and universities, I think, have become more competitive. And so a freshman, if you will, or a 12th grader who might have gotten into UNC 5 years ago might not have gotten in with this pool of incoming freshmen. So I think you have to have a sense of what the admission pool is at the institution your child is interested in applying to as well.
You know, one of the things that worries me is that back in my day, you had to pay attention to college admissions, and if you didn't, you would drop off and have to wait till next year to apply or go to work in the mill or something like that. But right now, it sounds like that for the increasing numbers of percentages of our kids are aspiring to go to college or ought to be going to college, but you have to spend the whole last part of your junior year and the early part of your senior year, you can't have fun and enjoy what you've earned to be a last year in high school. You got to be on mission, you know, spending all your time with the essays, taking the test, working to be sure that you've gotten the right recommendation letters and all of that.
And I think your observation is correct. And that's actually one of the reasons for the title, Within View,
with your book.
Within Reach.
Oh, no, where did the title come from? Tell us about that.
I think for me, I was a first-generation college student, and my mother worked in the school system as a school secretary and ultimately retired after 40 years. So she was very keen that her children would go to college, even though she did not have the opportunity, and my dad didn't go to college. And so my experience is, I think, maybe a bit of an exception, but I work with a lot of students through my work with the Alamance Burlington School System, through our nonprofit, the Yes I Can program, and just families that I've kept in touch with over the years. And I still think that conversation between a teenager and some adult, preferably the parent, is very, very important, because a lot of these students have an idea of what they want to be, whether it's an MBA player,
right,
or if it's
I still aspire
whether it's an author or whether it's a mechanical engineer, but they don't really have an idea of how to get themselves to that particular occupation or career. So part of I think the work that I do in this book is to encourage adults to talk to students about whatever it is they're interested in, and you have to bring that whatever it is, if you will, into view. And then you can figure out how you can help that teenager reach it. And sometimes I think parents have to expand kind of their minds, if you will. One of the examples I give in the book is there's a fellow Morehead and Rhodes Scholar who I think was a native of Canada. And her dream as a child was to go to Mars. And she told her parents all the time, I want to go to Mars. And you can imagine as a parent, you're saying to yourself, I need to get my child off that one. You know, we need to be an accountant, or we need to be a professor, or something that's going to be more stable, preferably with benefits. But this is a young woman who's doing some incredible cutting edge research. And I think probably some others are convinced that when we begin to do more exploration on Mars, she's going to be one of the individuals.
Well, what did her parents do with this ridiculous idea about going to Mars, and was that, did they handle it in a positive way?
From what I can tell, they did handle it in a positive way. I think, you know, they over time, they clearly saw she was interested in the sciences. I think they encouraged that in her regular schoolwork as well as summer camps. And ultimately, I think her undergraduate selection, you know, at Chapel Hill led her in a direction where she could get hands-on research and possibly be accelerated in some ways.
This was a part of your book that really, you know, socked at me, because I guess the typical wisdom in the establishment community is that there's a great danger because of all the little African-American boys running around wanting to be NBA players. Mm-hmm. What we got to do is to tell them that they can't be an NBA player. Now, you take a sort of different tack.
I absolutely do. My tack is, focusing on that relationship with the child. The child has to know that you're interested and engaged in what they're interested and engaged in. Then they get interested and engaged in what you would like for them to be interested and engaged in. I found when I started working, and I have two nephews who, as much as they love school, are convinced they're going to be NBA ballers. And so what I've learned from them and working in the school system is that when they come to you with this aspiration, they're energetic and excited. So I engage them in that conversation. I say, that's great. You know, tell me what your plan is. And once I understand what their plan is, I say, now, what's your plan B? And then they will at least give me a little bit of time to say, well, you like the sciences. Have you considered being an engineer? Or, you know, do you like this other area? My more recent example, and this will maybe get a chuckle from
Robin,
some folks.
We need to take a quick break. Will you say that? And we'll come right back and hear this example. We're visiting with Robin Hadley. She's talking about her new book, Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College Bound Journey. She and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Robin Hadley, who is the author of her first book, I think, of Within View, Within Reach. And its subtitle is Navigating the College Bound Journey. And Robin Hadley is sort of sharing some of the secrets from the book with us and doing it very cheerfully, Robin.
This is my favorite subject, and I could talk about it for a long time. I've had some pretty interesting experiences myself, and so this opportunity to write the book and work with students is a chance really to share with them some of my mistakes, but also some of my resources.
Well, we were talking before the break about something that I think real insight in your book and wisdom about handling I don't want to say the misguided aspirations of young people, but the typical teenage or preteen aspirations to be a celebrity in some fashion. And your advice, as you've talked about with the NBA basketball aspirants, rings really right with me. And I think you just made a convert out of me in terms of how to handle that.
I do think in observing particularly young men, young African-American males, but just males in general, when you say, you know, that's not realistic that you can go to the NFL or the NBA, there are too many examples for them out there that show that it's possible, whether it's a Julius Peppers or whether it's a LeBron James or whether it's any number of the stars in the NHL or in the soccer world. And so what I try to do is engage these students with what it is they really think they want to do, and then ask them some questions about how they're going to get there. At a minimum, I might be able to give them some answers for how they'll get there. The most important thing I'm doing is giving them probing questions to encourage them to think more about that particular initial aspiration. More recently, what I've been doing with particularly these young men is giving Harrison Barnes as an example. And so when they tell me they want to play college ball or D1 ball or NBA ball, I say, well, how many AP courses are you going to take? And they say, either what's an AP course or I'm not sure if I'm going to take AP courses. And I immediately give them the example of Harrison Barnes and the degree to which he seems to have prepared himself, and his mother has prepared herself and her son quite successfully, that this is the track that we need to be on. If we want to play for a very competitive D1 school that happens to be selective, then you need to take these AP courses. And so I have a link that I've sent principals and counselors and others to use as an example. And again, I think he's a great example because he carries himself in a very positive way. He's a stellar athlete, but at the same time, he's done the necessary work to lay the foundation.
It's clear that he's got his plan B.
Absolutely.
That he's likely to meet that goal of being an NBA player. And certainly, he's going to be a fine college basketball player. But if he breaks his leg, he's not closed out the plan B.
And the other thing I hope to try and convey, not just to these aspiring athletes but others, is that you have to be well-rounded. I even had the opportunity a few months ago to attend a play on campus, and he was at that play. And so no one really bothered him for autographs or anything because he was there to be entertained like everyone else at this particular cultural event. So I think it's very important to convey to students, you know, I think well-rounded might indeed be an overused term, but it really means knowing more than what's in the book, knowing more than maybe what's on the street corner, but knowing a number of different things so you can handle yourself in conversation, handle yourself with all kinds of people. And the bottom line is you've got to do the classwork.
Well, the book is obviously written in substantial part for parents as well. And you mentioned that you were first-generation college goer, and that the implication is that parents who haven't been to college have more to learn about the college-going experience and getting ready for it, that you need to hit them upside the head maybe a little bit harder even than other parents who have forgotten about all that or aren't in tune with what the modern requirements are.
Well, I think there's a couple of things for that particular parent. If that particular parent really is not that excited actually about their student going away to college, what I try to do to some degree in the book or when I'm working one-on-one with that particular parent is to explain to them what some of those benefits are of sending that student to college and what you need to be prepared for. If your child is going to be away from home for the first time, then you have to get used to the fact that you live in Wilmington and he's 3 hours down the road at college or university, and he'll have some homesickness, but you're going to have some homesickness too. And that it's an opportunity for that student to be exposed beyond that particular community. If that parent is an individual or it's a couple that's interested in having their child be a first-generation college student, in many, many instances, the first issue is money. How in the world do we pay for this? Because all they know is that I'm going to get a bill for tens of thousands of dollars, and how in the world do we pay for that? So I think part of it is beginning to understand how scholarships work, how financial aid works, how work study works, and trying to get information to student and parents in kind of bite-sized information, if you will, or even trying to pair them up with other parents who've been through the process themselves or who have children who've been through the process. And so we've been doing that, at least in Alamance County, through conferences and other types of things to get parents talking to other parents, because parents are going to listen to other parents, and at least what they're telling me from the book is some very there's step-by-step information in the appendices and some of the checklists that allow them to take the portions of the book they need, kind of leave the rest, and for some of them, they need all 10 chapters and the appendices.
Well, the thing, you know, all of us have these preconceived notions about the way things work, and my preconceived notion about North Carolina and the way it works is that where we've really succeeded is where we've found the children of parents who didn't go to college, who are intelligent and ambitious, and we open the doors for them to get the kind of education that will prepare them to make larger contributions. And by opening the door, I mean we've provided a, relatively speaking, inexpensive experience so that an ambitious kid can work and borrow a little bit. Yeah. Now that door is slamming shut. So unless you're able to get scholarships, as a poor person, you've got to go into debt. And it just, for parents who haven't been to college, they say, I just don't see how you're going to pay. You know, we don't operate that way.
Not only that, but I've also gotten some calls in the last year or two from parents who said, look, we had this thing wrapped up in a bow. But now the 401k has been hit. We've had to sell all of our Christmas tree property. Mm. You know, it could be a range of things. And even parents that knew their child was going to a four-year private institution at $50,000 plus per year are now saying, we've got to rethink this. So I do think the most important thing that we have in North Carolina that I think makes us the envy of a lot of other states and possibly some folks outside the United States is, again, this incredible network of public and private universities, as well as our community college system. I think that folks, I know folks like Shirley Ort and at UNC and others, and folks in financial aid at other institutions have worked extremely hard, I think, to raise private money, as well as to make sure that the universities and institutions can get whatever other government money is available to help kids. But it is still a confusing process. I do think our numbers for community college enrollment are going to continue to climb because the price tag is getting a little too much for the have-nots as well as some of the haves. One of the things that I'll share this with you, just two things very quickly. One of the most interesting conversations I ever had a chance to be a part of, we had a number of students in our community who were very interested in the Ivy League institutions, but we couldn't really figure out how to get them there on a college tour. Maybe one day that'll happen. So I posed the question to the admissions officers up at Harvard and Yale and Princeton if they would be available by phone. And I would put a group of people together in a library meeting room, and we would just dial them up. And they would answer questions. And I think it was a bit new at the time, the idea, but it went over extremely well. And one of the things that we learned from more than one of those institutions is that it's very hard to recruit a student who's Ivy League caliber who's residing in North Carolina, because we have some very competitive, selective institutions here, and so the options are many. So I think that tells our parents and our students something, that it's great if you can get accepted at one of the Ivies or even Stanford or University of Chicago, Emory, places like that, but that our institutions are very highly regarded by other institutions in this state as well as internationally. And when I lived abroad, it was not uncommon for me to bump into people, whether they were other college students, business persons, diplomats, or others, who knew immediately a handful of different colleges or universities in North Carolina if they weren't trying to figure out how to move to this region of the world in-state tuition.
You're a great salesman for our region and our state. We're visiting with Robin Hadley. She's the author of a new book, Within View, Within Reach. It's Navigating the College-Bound Journey. She and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Robin Hadley. She's the author of a new book, Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College-Bound Journey. And it's the result of her work over in Alamance County working with kids who ought to go to college, but who might not go to college because the ball's been dropped by somebody along the way. And Robin, let's take a break for just a minute and talk about your experience. As we mentioned earlier, you're a Carolina graduate, a Moorhead Scholar, and also a Rhodes Scholar. You studied in Oxford in England, and coming from a great family, but your first generation college going. So you got to be proud of your story, and you got to be, and your parents and people must have helped you along the way incredibly. So tell us a little bit about what's your story.
I'm probably one of the proudest people ever born and raised in Graham, North Carolina, half an hour down the road. It's a different world from Chapel Hill, and a lot of family born and raised in Alamance as well as Chatham. And I did have a whole lot of people, I think, from counselors and teachers and immediate and extended family, many of whom actually worked at the university when I was an undergraduate. And I think that's probably a part.
So you would be, I'm sorry, but I just love this image. So you're a little woman, African-American woman.
Country bumpkin.
A country girl coming in to Chapel Hill. And a whole bunch of other what we call country bumpkins come to Chapel Hill, and that's what's the basic strength. But you're walking up and down the pathways, and so you see somebody who might be working on the campus. You know them.
I do.
And you wave to them, and the other students are saying, hey, how do you know? How do you know?
Sometimes that's the case. There were times when I went to different events, and I had relatives who worked the cafeteria line or the reception line. I had an aunt who was a senior person at the university laundry, and just other people either from church.
Well, now when they smiled at you, they had to have a special feeling.
Yeah, but that puts a lot of pressure
No, but I mean,
you.
they... I mean, I just would like to be in your shoes just for a minute, or like to be in the shoes of the senior person at the laundry. And, you know, for many years, this institution, straight segregated, you know, the history is different. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, here's my cousin, that's my niece.
That's right. Her name was Lois Hadley. She's retired now, and... you're right. When we would go to church, I didn't get to see that particular aunt very much, but I did see others, and I think there was pride, you know, on their part because they didn't get to go to college, but they knew someone who did. I mentioned pressure because when you do walk through campus and you see people like that, when you're inclined not to go to class, you will usually get up and go ahead. But I think again at that particular time, I came here, you know, in the early '80s, and when you came to represent your family, your community, and a lot of different people. So to me, it was really inspirational to know that they were here, that many of them had worked here for almost their entire working careers. And there were a lot of other folks as well. I think folks, again, that worked in the cafeterias, that cleaned, that got all of that incredible toilet tissue out of the trees after football games. And they worked hard, and they loved Carolina just as much as anybody else. And so it was an interesting experience while I was an undergraduate.
Well, I hope maybe one of your next books will talk about that experience. I'm also interested in, as a little girl, when these outrageous ambitions to achieve and succeed begin to get hold of you, and whether or not that set you apart from some of the kids that you were going to school with, and how you dealt with that.
Well, I think part of it is how you frame it. My dad would have used the word outrageous. My mother would not. and I think part of that was because he was very, you know, a very traditional dad, and his primary focus as a provider and protector was to make sure that he could take care of the kids. And so when I would mention some of the things that I would do, fortunately it was not going to Mars, but it probably sounded like that at times. Yeah. To him. I always knew I wanted to travel around the world and go to places like New York and just do interesting things. And I think my dad's focus in our household was, you work hard, you tell the truth, you're a good person, and the world will be okay. My mother was the more academic person, I think, making sure we did the phonics cards, making sure we were at the library and the reading clubs and that type of thing. So it was a very healthy balance. And I think she knew from the books that I was reading that there was a whole world open to me. And I think the other thing that I have probably reflected on more probably in the last 10 years is that I went to kindergarten in 1968. I integrated a local private kindergarten in 1968. And I have often said to myself, I wonder how my parents felt letting me go into that kindergarten as a five-year-old. And because for me, it didn't matter to me. I remember very vividly, you know, being five or six and just wanting to go to school. And I knew, of course, that I was different, but I love to read. I do think that's another thing that my mother probably poured into me, is that I was an absolutely ravenous reader. So I could read about these places that I wanted to go to. So I think along the way, she again was that kind of parent, especially because she was an elementary school secretary. She had a sense of what a first grader is supposed to know, what a second grader is supposed to know.
So it may be an underappreciated asset to have a mama in the school system. So all of this communication that is so hard for most parents to get into the school and to sort of understand better what their child needs to be doing in order to prepare for college, you had an inside agent.
I absolutely had an inside agent. But I also think the other thing that was helpful, and I don't get to talk quite as much about this, is that my brothers kind of had a bit of a challenge coming behind me, as you might imagine.
I had one
that was 2 years younger. He actually came here to Chapel Hill and graduated, and he and his family now live in Encino, California. And I have a younger one who went to college for a year and just figured that college simply was not for him. And so we were three very different children. And I think my parents had to adapt how they dealt with us along the way to get us graduated from high school and where he wanted to go. And I also meet a lot of parents who have children on the other end of the academic spectrum. And what I mean by that is that parent who says, my child has a D average and it's fall of the senior year. What are we supposed to do? And One of the things that I think is a mantra in the book is I try to convey to people, start where you are. If you've got a sixth grader that's just jumping out of the box to be a scientist, plug him in her or her into camps and keep them busy. But if you have a child who is not motivated in the least except to play video games, if that, then you've really just got to stay behind them, hopefully, to get them graduated, which is what happens with a lot of students. And they don't really figure out where they want to go after high school, usually until that summer after graduation when everyone's leaving for college. So what I've also found these last few years is that you can't just give up on those students who are not your top 25% or who have that 2.9 and below. Those kids have value. They might have fallen in a hole or along the way, but they have to be given some kind of direction or guidance because they're going to be 22 or 32 or 42 one day. And everything that happens in that educational experience, K through 12, plays a role in the kind of adult and hopefully civic-minded, tax-paying, easy-to-get-along citizen that we would all like for these children to become.
We're visiting with Robin Hadley. She is the author of a new book, Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College-Bound Journey. She and I will be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Robin Hadley. Robin Hadley is the author of Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College-Bound Journey. And also, if you joined us late, she's a graduate of Carolina. She was a Morehead Scholar and then became the first African-American woman from the South to receive is not the right word, to earn a Rhodes Scholarship. And so she studied in Oxford, and she brings a perspective back to Alamance County, where instead of helping herself, she's helping others deal with the challenge of going to college. Before we leave, though, Robin Hadley, talk about those of us who kind of, I mean, you know, we're proud of you, but we're green with envy, too. We're jealous of the experience that Rhodes Scholars have in Oxford. And right before he died, Reynolds Price, who is one of North Carolina's first Rhodes, well, it was an early Rhodes Scholar, wrote his memoir about the experience of living in Oxford and going to school in the late 50s, early 60s era. What was it like in the 80s?
Interesting. In many ways, medieval. Like the books and pictures you read about.
These
Oxford
are old buildings and old people.
These are really old buildings. But at the same time, just the international community was incredible. Just people from all over the world, both fellow students and instructors, and the opportunity to travel the world.
Well, now, I don't want to push you on this, but here in reading about these experiences, that groups develop at Oxford. And from my generation, of course, it was all male. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and it was all white almost. Mm-hmm. It was all white. And so there was this clubby atmosphere. But nevertheless, Europeans, Americans, and all that, all these people kind of get. But now you come in, first you're a Southerner, and then you're an American.
Right.
You're African-American. You're female, and so you got a broader reach to other groups of people. I mean, what tribe did you sign up with?
Well, several of them, but I tried to make sure I wasn't as busy as I was at Chapel Hill, so I'd have plenty of time to travel, to be quite honest. But I do think you're correct that there are times, I think, when an individual in that position can feel they're at a disadvantage because they are so different from the environment they're going into. But I do go back to my mom's teaching, other teachers, folks like Mebbin and Betsy Pritchett. The late Mebbin Pritchett was executive director of the Morehead Foundation at the time. Jimmy Wright was at the Morehead Foundation now with Jefferson Scholars. Those were two guys, just among others, along with the late Hayden Renwick, who was at Chapel Hill. and many, many others who I wish I had time to name. But those were individuals, I think, who helped me.
Who prepared you for this transition.
Absolutely. And it was interesting because when you got there, you got to hang out with the athletes. I actually played basketball while I was at Chapel Hill. Some of my fellow guard was the Honorable Susan Rice, who's now U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And one of my fellow classmates was a man by the name of George Stephanopoulos.
And we've heard those names.
It was just interesting because I think everyone was ambitious in a different kind of way, and you just felt like the world was your oyster. You didn't know where you would end up. At the same time, it was an opportunity to meet other African Americans who from across the United States who found themselves in Oxford and able to communicate maybe in ways, particularly socially,
right.
that they may not have had an opportunity.
Oh, I'd love to hear more about this. All right, now, but there's one other part of your life that we're running out of time, but
sure.
And that's your church. And it's not unusual for to see successful African American professionals hold on to their church membership. But I mean, you've been so educated and challenged and everything. How does the church experience hold up against this challenging academic and critical examination that you give to religious your religious views?
Well, I think, again, for me, I think that many of the things I've been able to do in my life are nothing short of divine intervention, to be quite honest. I think if you've been the
Do you first, really believe that, or are you
I
just
do.
Saying that?
No, I absolutely believe that. And I think there are a couple of reasons that play into this. Again, going back to the childhood experiences, I'm the granddaughter and great-granddaughter of founding pastors of churches, one in Chatham County and one in Alamance County. So I had a very rich church experience. And I do think for a period of time, particularly when I was in college, I got away from that, which I don't think is uncommon. But I think ultimately you have to be rooted and grounded in something. And for me, that was my church experience. And ultimately, what happened during the time that I lived in Virginia, I had the chance to join a church which I call was a teaching church. So in the very same way that I would have set out to take professional development courses at my job or in other parts of my life, I began to take courses at that particular church, which had a great Christian education program. And so I had a chance, the way I described it in terms of self-examination, was that if I wanted to be the best athlete in the world, then I did certain kinds of things to get to play D1 ball. If I wanted to be competitive at a certain class, there were certain things I did to prepare. And if I wanted to understand more about this denomination that I was in or what was in this Bible, then I was going to have to take some classes and begin to answer some of those questions on my own. And for me, I got answers that were very, very important. And I think the other thing that happens in the black church is that the church is not just about that Bible. The church is a social center. For me, it was a business because I had family members that were involved in the actual operations of the church. And you can't pay the light bill if you don't
If you don't pass the collection plate one or two or three times.
Absolutely. So I think the opportunity, again, that sense of family, but also just understanding the historic role that the church has played in this country and especially in the African-American community.
Well, we've come together in so many different ways, but the churches, the African-American churches, seem to have a special historical both background and reach into mm-hmm. the African-American religious experience so that it's just different. You find people unwilling to break away and go join what we call a white church or a integrated church or something
like that. Well, I do think some of that is changing. I think with the advent of the mega churches, I think also with more families looking for churches that have kind of a menu of activities, whether it's daycare or whether it's summer camps or that kind of thing, we will see more of that. But I do think I think probably my pastor would even tell you that I think our church should be doing more as far as community outreach is concerned. I think sometimes we get comfortable with where we are and we can just do more in the community. So we're doing some of those things at our church, like summer camps, enrichment programs, college tours, and that type of thing, and partnering with some of the other churches in our community to do that.
Well, can we come? Tell us about your church and can we come visit?
You sure can. It's Children's Chapel United Church of Christ in Graham on Hardin Street, 334 East Hardin Street. And I've been able able to work with some of our folks there to establish a program called the Yes I Can program. It's called Youth Enrichment Series, and we base there at the church, but on some Saturdays during the summer, we do a whole day of programs. It could be etiquette, it could be interviewing skills, filling out scholarship applications. It might even be some speakers like Sam Perkins and others that we've been fortunate to come and talk about their experiences as an athlete, but also his experiences as an entrepreneur.
Well, what a treat, Robin Handley, to learn about your book, about your experience, and to celebrate to celebrate your return to Chapel Hill, even for just a minute.
Thank you so much. Grateful
for what you've taught us. Our guest has been Robin Handley. She's the author of Within View, Within Reach, Navigating the College Bound Journey. Thanks to her, and thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here before you know it.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, your home for progressive talk. It's the Stephanie Miller Show from 9 a.m. until noon, only on News Talk 1360, WCHL.